Yeah, hi, here's Uwe Ball, and my company's name is Event Films.
Hey, it's Kellen, and today on Diversified Game, I have Uwe Ball. And if you go Google his name, especially you YouTubers out there who've never made one film, you'll see people saying some things about him, worst director, this, that. I'm taking that title because you have to go put in Amazon my movie that was shot on a camera and a body cam. And then you go watch his movies who have real stars in them. He's done over 22, 23 movies that the internet wants to give him credit for. And I'm going to demystify, and he's going to give us the game that, you know, how they say he made his claim to fame, which you have to give him credit for, is he's raised over $400 million dollars to do this, and he's made 23 films. How many have you done, people? But Uwe, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Yeah, hi. I'm in Germany. It's getting dark outside. Everything's good. So
good. And I'm glad we got our reception. You guys, you know, if you hear anything, please, we're working with, you know, some crazy weather times here in the States, at least, and maybe globally. But let me know. Let's start off with, what do you think when people who only critique, maybe they have made no films, but they are on YouTube and they're critiquing your multi-million dollar projects when they try to discredit you? This is a learning moment for me and the audience when people talk negatively about you and they're not doing what you have done.
I mean, I always try to give the audience the room, you know, to criticize me. I talk also with everybody. If people send me on Facebook a message, I always answer. But of course, you feel also very disrespected in a way, you know, if you get trashed because you put a lot of work in it. And it's not like if somebody doesn't like a film like House of the Dead, whatever, you know, it doesn't mean that I'm an asshole. Or I'm, you know, or I'm like a total loser myself the whole time because one film you didn't like. And I think I did a lot of different films, a lot of different quality too. I mean, not all of my films were good. I mean, I have to be clear. But as a filmmaker and a film buff myself, I always knew that there are thousands and thousands of films out there that are way worse than my films. And so this kind of credit they gave me, like, you're the worst filmmaker ever, I felt the whole time that's just bullshit. It's just that is just made up, and then everybody run with it. If they put the stamp on you, and you know, then they're like running with it, and all the bigger journalists of the bigger newspapers too, they took it from the internet basically, and then they always started all their articles with the line, "The people say he's the worst director." So they were hiding behind the anonymous internet trolls, basically. So they said, they didn't wrote it, "I think he's the worst director," but they brought it in every article up, in everything. And it tired me out after a while, you know, because you feel like, I don't know how to defend anything. And I don't know how to defend very good films I did, you know, Darfur about the genocide in Sudan, Rampage, Assault on Wall Street about the bailouts of the banks. They're good films, and everybody who watched them said they are very good. So, and that is the thing. But then you don't get credit for anything, even if you do a total different film as House of the Dead or Alone in the Dark were. And yeah, so, but I always try to take it with humor. You know, so to just like not taking it too much that I get like an ulcer or something.
No, you can't, because you know what you've done, even with the video game franchise and film, tell the people, because a lot of people are, you know, they're making money off your idea and film and video game. So how did you, you know, come to do that? Like, what gave you the idea to do that? Then you had to convince people to fund that. So, you know, people, you really need to listen and learn, take notes, because they're going to tell you too, you can't do this, that you can't do that. You don't do this as good as that person. But how did you start mixing the movies and the video games together?
It was like, I'm a big zombie fan, like the real, like Dawn of the Dead, the George R. Romero films, and 28 Days Later, stuff like this. And I got the script for House of the Dead that what I knew only as the game in the arcades, where you sit down and shoot zombies, basically. And I felt maybe I can make a zombie film I always wanted to do using that game as a brand to do it. So we did House of the Dead. And it got a release. It made 12 million box office. So it was not a huge hit, but it was also not a flop. And it made like almost 30 million bucks in DVDs alone. So it was a big DVD home video hit, also a Blockbuster and so on. And that was when you said in the beginning, I raised 400 million bucks from investors. I like because House of the Dead then turned into a success. Financially, I will raise more money from investors who specifically told me we want this kind of film. We like the idea of having a video game attached to a film, and it's a cross-promotion opportunity.
Okay. Did it make it any easier to fund, because you're, mixing two genres, two arenas?
Recently, we saw more and more video games, The Last of Us and a Dungeon. Yeah. So I think I, in a way, paved the way.
They also say, and I'm bringing this up to let people, it's a teachable moment. They say you were able to make films because of the perfect timing, and in Germany, I guess there were some tax breaks, and there's one YouTuber who did this whole thing. He's in everybody's pocket, and he's showing, like, there's these tax breaks, which I didn't think that was a negative. I thought that was a positive. Who wants to pay more tax? So talk about that, because I find that to be using, the resources and the laws, and you weren't breaking any laws. But how did
No.
come up with that? Was that your idea, or was it just the right time?
No, it was the right time. There were other funds, other people, they raised money already for films with investors in Germany. And the idea, what was sometimes even written in Wikipedia about it, was not the truth that the investors didn't want to invest to lose their money, but they wanted to invest first their money. And on paper, they of course lost it because first you produce the film and the money is gone. So then they can write off 50% from that investment basically to the government. So they don't have to pay, they save taxes with it. So to say it's easier, like let's say somebody makes 200,000 bucks a year and would pay normally 100,000 in taxes to make a very a clear cut accounting. If he would invest 200,000 in a film at that point, he wouldn't pay zero taxes, zero. So now it was not so hard to get investors because investors said, I don't want to pay taxes. I better invest in the film. So, but of course, they hoped over time when the film came out and whatever, they're getting money back and making revenues. And I recoup very good money with A House of the Dead and Alone in the Dark. And so I got more money. People came in and said, look, your films are actually making money. I invested in other films, they don't make any money. So that was the reason that it blowed up to like the 400 million bucks that we could do like in the name of the king, like with the Dungeon Siege with Jason Statham for like 80 million bucks. So we had like massive amount of money coming in. And then 2005, the government in Germany destroyed that. So they said, no, you cannot do that anymore. Like you cannot write off investment in films. And that basically destroyed in Germany a lot of filmmakers because the only way for German films in a way to be international is to shoot America, shoot with US stars. And because German actors are not known around the globe, maybe two or three actors, around the globe from Germany. And so they basically cut off the possibility of German investors to make real films for the world. And that is where I went and founded my event film. And I lived in Canada a long time in regards of making then films more the classical way with sell pre-selling rights and getting other investors. So, yeah, but it was a great time where I was able to raise so much money to do all that films.
And when you went to Canada, you've also, you know, expanded into the restaurant business. I don't think it's open at this moment, but you know, people hear 80 million, they hear restaurant, they hear, you know, all I have to do is make that one movie and my life will change and I will be rich and I never have to, you know, work again, which you've done 23 movies, so that could fairly be the case. For that young filmmaker out there, what would you tell them on trying to make that one hit? So if they don't want to, they never have to work again. What is it going to take? What do those numbers look like? How much time do you have to put in?
Yeah, and look, and when the money came back, like from Alone in the Dark, like or House of the Dead, around like 25, 30 million bucks were actually the real revenues of the films. Then you have to pay most back to the investors. What I did, right? So I maybe made a million on House of the Dead or Alone in the Dark, and not like 10 or 20 million. So I amalgamated, let's say, what I have based on I made so many films. So, you know, to keep going and to keep grinding and to get other films produced and done was really not a one-hit wonder. I mean, of course, these things happen too. When you do the Blair Witch Project, I think that guys with one film, they made like 50 to 80 million bucks in their pockets, like the filmmakers. They never had to work again. But I also don't know if they ever actually worked again. I never heard from them again. So I don't know if they're still in the business or just be in the Bahamas or something. I really don't know. And I think for a young aspiring filmmaker, it's maybe even the worst thing what can happen to you is that you're very young and you have a huge smash hit, because from this point on, it will go downhill. So there is like this kind of where you want to be after Blair Witch Project, basically. You will never make another film what will do $250-$300 million box office and was produced for like $500,000. So I think some directors who got big critical acclaim with their first films had that problem later too, that they couldn't follow up the quality also, because they made the first film. For example, Boogie Nights was great from Paul Thomas Anderson. You know, I loved that film with Mark Wahlberg and so on. But how many other great films he did after basically his first film? And you know, it was like you will barely find another film who was so good as his first film. And I think some directors have this. They coming in and then they're the big, everybody talks about them. And then is the question, what will happen after? So for me, it was good that I, in a way, I never had this one-hit wonder mega success. It was all like always working towards to break even and to get the money back.
And when you get the money, of course, you get new friends, new family members. Can you talk about some of the community give back? Because everybody likes to be able to give back in their own way. But what's something that you've also been able to, you know, do with the money to give to the community, or something that you would like to do in the future?
Yeah, look, in I mean that I come first with the negative side. So for example, when I opened the restaurant in Vancouver, all our crew in a way felt the guy doesn't need to make money with the restaurant. And they kind of abused it, you know, free drinks, whatever. Like when I was not there, they were drinking the bar empty and felt like, nah, he doesn't care. But of course, it's like, of course you care, because you don't want to get like cheap, like cheated on, right? From your crew. That is the thing where that happens with other businesses or other films, that people think, oh, they can take advantage of you. But what we did, for example, in Darfur, we shot like with a lot of Sudanese refugees, and a few of them we paid after to get a nurse education, you know, to get them out of the township in South Africa. And that had nothing to do with the film budget. That was basically me and the other producer and the DP, the camera guy. We said, look, we cannot have these people now playing in the film and going back in the slum, because we got them out of the refugee centers, right? And so we helped them getting out of there. And Darfur didn't make any money later as a film, But I think that is where when you have some money, you can start helping this. Or, for example, I gave a lot of money to the anti-poaching units in Africa, who are basically trying to catch the hunters, you know, killing the rhinos and elephants and whatever. And you need to pay people on the ground driving around with jeeps and actually stopping them and killing the last rhinos and stuff. So that are, I do more personal things, like direct things. I'm not the guy who gives to a charity in a way, because they're all like spending all the money on advertising. You know, when you have like this kind of big charities, then see they're flying around with a private jet to galas and collect money. And you think, no, I don't want that. I want to help people that are directly, that I help them directly to get forward. And that I do basically here in Germany also for a long time. And yeah, I mean, but on the other hand, I helped a lot of young filmmakers, you know, helping them that their films getting sold, that are getting distributed, that are getting made, and said, look, you can piggyback on my next film, and you can shoot your film right after, and you get like 2 weeks the equipment I rented, you know, like stuff like this. And that is also a good thing to basically bring people to that level forward, that they can make a real film.
And with, you know, film right now, you know, here in America, everybody's on strike. People are moving to Mexico. They're going everywhere they can afford to live. What are your thoughts as a director on, you know, why the actors, the writers, and everybody here is, you know, boycotting? Is it justified? Should they then, you know, create their own so they don't have to, you know, worry about getting the small minute royalty check that an Amazon or a Hulu will give you? Like, what's the solution?
I mean, now the writers, in a way, did a deal, right? So, and I understood the main point for the strike is the use of AI. So, and I understand that actors don't want to get, like, scanned and then, like, see themselves in movies, but they were never on set. I mean, that is ridiculous, you know? So, and that was, for me, the reason why the strike made sense. But then the strike is dragging on too long now. I mean, at one point, you have to sit down. What the writers did now, but they should did that 4 weeks ago, where actually the main CEOs, like Ted Sarandos from Netflix and the Zaslav from Warner Brothers, they did finally the deal. They were like sitting with them, discussing the points, and came to a conclusion. And the question is, why they never did that before? Why are they waiting 4 months? Because I felt a little with, like, for example, Bill Maher, the talk show host, said that too. He said, look, now we have, everybody is unemployed. The gaffer, the driver, the caterer, the makeup woman. I mean, the moment the actors started striking, you had a full shutdown of the film industry, and a lot of people are suffering. They cannot pay the rent. And that is not the actors. I felt a lot of the actors are making big speeches, but these are people, you know, like when Ron Perlman, I worked with him on In the Name of the King. I love Ron Perlman, but he did a very speeches and he acted like he's a working class guy, but he's not. He makes like millions every year, you know? So, and that is like, he cannot really know, maybe he knows it from the past, but he doesn't know now that people need to pay the rent. And if you're a small time crew member, especially like technical crews, like electricians and so on, they cannot afford to not work for 4 months. They're getting done, they're getting under, you know, and getting thrown out of their apartments. And that is the thing where I felt that is not okay, that they now basically play that game, who has the bigger balls here. That was for me a little the feeling with the actors, that it was this kind of like just all railed up and not about the point anymore. They should settle on. I mean, the AI, they cannot, the streamers and the studios, they should agree that you cannot copy people and use them and don't pay them for it. If somebody says, look, you can scan me and use me for any movie, but you have to give me $1 million, that is different to you get $500 for a day job. Now we scan you, and then from this point on, you're in every episode of The Mandalorian, but we don't pay you for it. That is ridiculous. And that has to get like wiped off, this thing. So there need to be protection, right? But at the same time, with the writers, when I actually read that a writer in a writer's room gets $12,000 a week, you know, then I felt like, are you kidding me? Like $50,000 a month. That is insane. That is like, and they were whiny. And you feel like, how can you be whiny if you make $50,000? I wrote, like, before I made any money, I wrote like 50 scripts and got not a dime for it, you know? So, and that is the thing where I felt like they were discussing on a higher level and not like construction workers at a car plant or something. And, you know, but they were acting in public like they're the poorest people on earth. And then you read like $12,000 a week. That was insane. That's just an insane amount of money if you're not like John Grisham or somebody.
Yeah. In the words of Lauryn Hill, it's funny how a money changes situation, because when you are at certain levels, I heard of a very popular stuntman for one of the biggest comedians and actors ever. And don't worry, you guys, I won't say the name, but he was saying how the writer's strike wasn't so bad. And of course, you've been making movies for over 30 years and you have a nest egg and, you know, you've taken care of your money. So, but for the young person who just started, maybe first, you know, got their first apartment or house off that money, some of them have left to Mexico, if you can see behind me, you know, because they only have $1,000 a month to live off. And here in South Florida, I can tell you things are not getting any cheaper. Can you talk to the people, you know, being a director, you have power to everybody else, but you also have to answer to the studio and those, you know, and they're on you all day, all night. Can you talk about, you know, taking control of the set, the narrative, the movie, but also having to deal with the financiers? Like, it has to be a pain in the neck. It has to, you know, be the things that cause some people heart attacks. How do you manage, you know, just staying in this crazy business for so long?
Yeah, I mean, that is the thing. It's a good question, actually, because some people, like some actors also in interviews later, said like Uwe was sitting on the set and he was doing emails, you know, like acting like a director should be like just never answer an email. And I answered always, guys, I'm the producer myself, too, and I have investors. And so when you change the camera position and you change the lights and you change everything, that takes 15, 20 minutes. So why I should not answer some emails? Well, you want that I answer all my emails at 2 a.m. in the hotel room or whatever, when, you know, like that is the thing. So I had to be very efficient. And I know that maybe for some directors, it's unthinkable to not be the whole time just focused on what the directing job is. But I said always like, no guys, I'm a producer myself. And I have to also take care of the finances and the responsibility. So I double task sometimes. But of course, when you actually work with the actors, you're not answering emails. So, but film is everybody who is doing film knows there's a lot of technical issues or a lot of technical thing, and you move around. And as a director, sometimes you have free time. You have time to concentrate for 15 minutes on what came in. And I get every day hundreds of emails from people like, because I could not eradicate my past, right? So if I basically shot In the Name of the King with Jason Statham, there were emails coming in from House of the Dead, Korea, or, you know, like, or Alone in the Dark in Brazil. Like, where's the print? Where, you know, like, where's the lab? Why we never got the HD master? Like, shit like this came in all the time. And you have to work it away. I told people also, you have to understand me, like I'm really running an operation and I cannot not answer my emails every day. Then I have thousands of emails. If I like 2 months shut down my computer completely, or 4 weeks even, I have like 5,000 emails and they're getting nastier and nastier. Like people will completely lose their shit on me, you know? And so that is, I think they had to understand that I was doing it, most of the actors didn't really care, but some actors later said that in interviews. And interesting was Clint Howard, the brother from Ron Howard. He said in an interview, he was in various of my films, he said, Uwe has always the struggle director against producer, because he's both, right? And he said, and the producer always wins. So it was, for me, funny, because he felt like, in a way, you can say the greed always wins, you know, that I, as a producer, also want to make money. But you can also say the brain was always winning. You know, like that I was not like, I know so many people, they did two movies, whatever, then they disappeared forever. And the reason that I made so many films, I think, was also that I kept the ship going and kept the shit like, you know, that I fulfilled my contractual obligations to everybody.
And if these people really knew who was financing some of these things, and we won't go deep into that, if you know, you know. It's like going to like car racing or dressage or polo. You know, there's not, you know, 15 horses over there because these are the nicest people you're getting money from. They want to look at their investment. I tell people the reason why we're at a certain level is I won't take money from certain people because it's almost like taking money from the mob. You pick which one you want, but they're going to be on you. VC is the mob. They want you and they want to get you out of there as soon as they can when you're profitable. So people have to understand that, you know, when you take money, it's not free. It's never free when you take money. Can you tell the people with the future of your films, and then if you have ownership of those films, to even maybe make your own, you know, Web3 portal, because everyone's talking, what's the next big thing? And I'm like, why don't directors just take all their films and things they produce, put it in their own portal, you control it, and whoever your kids or whoever's after you, they get to, you know, benefit off that. What do you think the future is with your films?
I mean, the most of my films are in a way everywhere available, like Amazon, whatever, Apple. And it's, of course, a good idea to control your own revenue stream. Because at Amazon, for example, if you're on Amazon Prime, you get just 10 cents per view. You know, it's not a lot of money. And so, of course, it would be nicer to have your own, like the Uwe Boll film, like streamer. The question is then, but then you have to advertise it too, and that costs money. And that is also what you don't have to do if you're like on all the other streamers. They advertise it in a way on their own, and of course they take a big cut away from you. And yesterday a call from an actor, and talked with him, and he said, look, basically all the distributors, they have other people pay the films, and then they act like they own the films, and their corporate value, including the stock price, goes up based on films they never paid. They just distributed them. And then acting like, you know, they're writing them in there when they go public in the stock market. They say, we have a library of 5,000 films. But they don't write that from the 5,000 films, they actually own only 500. And the other 4,500, they were just distributing them. For people like me, you know, Lionsgate doesn't own House of the Dead or Alone in the Dark or 20th Century Fox. They don't own Blood Rain or In the Name of the King, but they're acting like they own it. You know, yeah. So they basically would put that on the corporate value, what that film's gross. And that it's kind of strange, you know, it's kind of a strange feeling to it. But I mean, it is what it is. And right now, the whole worldwide distribution model, in a way, changed so much. It's now, in earlier years, it was like the movie came out in movie theaters. Then you had Blu-ray, DVD, you had Blockbuster, you had that rental. And, you know, and then you went to TV. Now it's all about streaming. It's basically theatrical. Is if you don't have Barbie or Oppenheimer, it's like over. Like theatrical brings absolutely nothing. And then you have DVD and Blu-ray. They don't even want to do it anymore because it's expensive to produce them and not enough sales. So you basically can pick what streamer gets my film first or parallel or whatever. But it's this kind of thing. And then I think the main question for the future in filmmaking is how I promote my film when it comes out, so you get the maximum amount of views. Like, what can I do to make my films bigger in the streamer that it's running, that people go and watch it based on a total parallel advertising, maybe. That could be a channel, a YouTube channel or something, you know, like, or you work with influencers, you give them a part of the movie. You say, look, we make that movie big, but only we together, you know, stuff like this. And that are things I'm thinking about it. And but then you need people, they are movie, in a way, movie fans. They want to work with you on it. You know, if Mr. Beast says, watch Uwe Boll's movie Postal, I bet I would make 10 million bucks the next day on the streaming services, you know? So, and but you need the right partner or somebody who says, I do it not only for the money, also because I like the films and want to push them.
Which gives the talent more ways of ownership, which I think more people are becoming, you know, savvy about that. And they want that. They keep hearing about, okay, my rights, my image, you know, in everything that we do. It's a beautiful thing. I represent influencers, so that one hits hard because I do have people who call, hey, we want to do this movie. Okay, put my client in the movie. Don't just come do the interview. Put him in the movie so he can talk about him being in the movie. And then we can talk about, like Kevin Hart said many years ago, you can pay me to promote it, which really pissed some people off, but it changed the game where people are like, okay, is this the new move? I love that because if you do have whatever big influencer promote it, you don't necessarily need an Amazon or an iTunes, and you could have your on your own platform where you get the bulk of the money, because these CPMs and these streams, we barely know how to calculate them. I don't care what they say in their, you know, policy and other thing. What's really happening, even on the pirating side, it's unfair to the talent, and I, you know, it's just unfair. So can we hear from you a new movie coming for this year or next year? Is that in the works?
Yeah, so I shot a police film in New York, First Shift. Is basically Gino Pizzi. He was in Shades of Blue with Jennifer Lopez and Kristen Renton. She was in Sons of Anarchy. Yeah, so I love her. She's really great. And they play this odd couple. He doesn't want her as a partner. She comes from Atlanta. She and he's a New Yorker, and he doesn't want her. He wants to drive alone, and then they have to do that first shift together. And of course, a lot of humor in, but also a lot of action and violence. So it was great. The trailer is on YouTube. If you put in like First Shift, what comes the trailer? And I have various offers now, exactly what we just talked about, of distributors, you know, and they're all like similar offers. It's this kind of like, we need to put it on five screens only. Like five screens means nothing. So, and then we qualify for the higher run in the, you know, in the streamers and blah, blah, blah. They basically offer me exactly the same. And that is the thing. It's like this kind of everybody functions in the same world. And I think with the influencers, what you just said is maybe not for this film because it's done and it can release it soon. But for future films, that idea to bring also an influencer who has some talent in the film. Because what you don't want is an influencer who sucks in the movie. You know, you want somebody who could act, who could be a valuable, let's say if it's a singer guy, you write a scene where he can perform. Or you have a guy who is actually could act and could play a big supporting part or even a lead part. And then you do similar what Taylor Swift is doing now, right? So she cashes in on all ends. Like now the movie will be a huge blockbuster. I think the movie about the concert tour will make almost the same money like Oppenheimer, you know? So yeah, that would be the way to go in the future.
Yeah, and I have a great news channel when you're ready for that, that can, you know, play themselves. And, you know, when you talk about news, it's like I love when I would see like Wolf Blitzer in the movies, or you would see Anderson Cooper. And it doesn't always have to be of the biggest caliber. And I'm totally biased, but you let me know when you're ready for that. I did see the trailer for that. And I'm just curious with that movie coming out, because it looked like a really good trailer. Will you be doing conferences? The NATPE in Miami is back. We no longer have to go to Budapest. The National Association of Television Producers and Executives, you guys, the tickets are available now. And no, they don't pay me to say that. But I enjoy that conference, and I'm here in South Florida now, finally. So will you be attending anything like that or any other conferences?
Yeah, the American Film Market in Los Angeles in end of October, beginning of November. And here in Cannes, in France, my business partner will go to Cannes to the MIP TV. But the thing in Miami is good. Let's do after our talk, let email me the contact, you know, like what that is, because that is maybe the right conference also to pitch a TV series I have in the works, of also a cop TV series, you know, and I'm open to when is that conference? When will that be?
That's going to be November 3rd.
Oh, that is parallel to the American Film Market. That is crazy, basically.
Why? Well, that's why they claimed bankruptcy last year. I believe, you know, allegedly, we'll say. But yeah, there's a couple of other things that it's interacting with that, you know, film people may want to go. But who knows? Again, you know, they're not asking us yet for their opinion. There's probably a reason. Maybe they got a discount at the hotel at the Fontainebleau. I don't know. It's also the reason why everybody at the NATPE, and I mean when I say this, everyone loves MIP more than that, you know, and they rather fly out anywhere besides go to that conference. But that's a whole nother thing. You guys can call me, hire me, and we can talk about that. I love this conversation, but I really want the people to go check out the films and go see what you have new, and, you know, let them know any last words. And maybe you have a film that will turn into a book, or a book that may become a film on your own personal life. Anything in the works?
No, look, I do a shout out to Wesley Snipes. So I made him an offer. I want to bring him back as an action star. What we all know him from Blade. And I have a great film for him, Salem Watts. It's a film would bring him back as an action actor. And because of the strike, he never answered my offer. Mm. You know, because they're not like officially cannot read whatever. But when the strike is over, maybe he listens to this podcast from you, you know, and he should do that film. I love him as an actor. And he's due to come back. I mean, Denzel Washington is too old now. Yeah. And he had a big success with Equalizer. But I think he's definitely way older as Wesley Snipes. Like, so, and I think the Equalizer was a big success. I like this kind of films. There are not so many films like this getting done anymore. And it was one of the reasons I did First Shift, you know, because I like Training Day and this kind of films. And I'm not getting the films in the movie theaters anymore I want to watch. And, you know, I go with my kids. I was in the Ninja Turtles film recently, you know, and before I was in Transformers 5. But there are only the films I sit there and for the kids. And it's not that they're bad films or something, but I would love to have another, like, Training Day or films like this where you went out of the movies and you felt like, wow, that was great.
Well, we might have to come to another country, because everything in America you can get canceled for. And, you know, people can't take a joke, or, you know, I want to say other things, but I may get canceled for that too. I can't be canceled because I'm not looking for their approval. But Wesley Snipes, you've heard that. Wesley, if you don't take it, Michael Jai White, maybe you come through. You know, I don't know the relationship, but before I let you go, you mentioned Bill Maher. You know, someone like Bill Maher, who has, you know, done things for decades, but he can go on comedy tour. He can, he has Club Random, which is a really great podcast. Yeah. You know, Bill Maher, maybe, you know, we're reaching out there too, since you got a shout out earlier. It's really a lot of actors are such purists where they're like, I don't even want to do YouTube. Like, even I have friends who, you know, nobody knows them yet, on the big screen, but they're like, I don't want to do YouTube because I'm scared of being, you know, blacklisted. Do you think that's fair that a Bill Maher can do what he wants to do, but a up and coming actress is paranoid of, you know, taking that plunge?
I mean, I love Bill Maher and I watched the talk show since like 20 years. And what I like is that he is not, I mean, of course he voted for like Obama and whatever, gave him $1 million, but he has a lot of opinions that are not for the Democrats and they are more Republican, you know, and I'm also like a free thinker, you know, I have like political opinions about some stuff that are more Republican. I have more Democratic views on other stuff, you know, and the thing is, it's very bad right now, especially for comedy or stand-up comedians, you know, that they, if one joke hits the nerve of the Twitter trolls, basically, they're post and then they're out of business, you know, because they made the wrong joke on the wrong spot where you had like only Karens in the audience flipping completely out on you. And I think it's ridiculous. I miss comedies like Naked Gun and stuff like this, you know, they're too scared. Even Hangover, what nobody do anymore, you know. Yeah. And I feel that is cultural very bad that we don't do ridiculous humor and satire. I think it's very important to continue with like being ruthless and being like comedy should insult people. I mean, you know, like when you're always in your comfort zone, then it's not funny. Funny is when you're out of your comfort zone, when you think, holy shit, yeah, then it starts to be funny. And a lot of people look for me, they look for me like they are like kind of the mind control. And that is, I think, one of the biggest weakness of the Democrats in the U.S. or here in Germany, of our government here right now, is that they, in a way, reduce your personal freedom. And people don't want that. They don't want to be shy to say what they really think about problems. They don't want to be censored to make a dirty joke or something. That is very bad that they do that. And that makes, of course, people like Trump bigger. There are a lot of people, I think, that vote for Trump, even if they disagree with basically everything what he's doing, but they vote for him because they don't want the other side. You know, they feel oppressed.
So would you say, I mean, you've lived in Canada, you've lived, you know, all over, you know, Germany, one thing Germany does that America should do, they don't try to hide their history. You guys, you know, confront and let it be known, and you teach history and don't try to revise it. Do you find that, you know, the German audience, and this is something that's probably never been said, has maybe more of a sense of humor now than American audience? You guys don't have a bunch of Karens out there. I've been to Cologne and different places. You know, you're quite free to be whoever you want to be. So do you find that Germany might have more, you know, of a sense of humor than America right now?
Maybe, but not a lot, because I don't know when you went here, but 2 years ago we got the new government with the Green Party and the Social Democrats, and they are more like the Karens, you know, like if you don't do it this way, whatever, on the bike you need a helmet on the bike, you need, you know, like this kind of regulations what slowly destroys your personal freedom. And they are very much on this, and that a lot of people don't like this. You know, you cannot go fishing in the river without having the permit to go fishing. Like 20 years ago, you were just fishing in the river. You know, nobody gave a shit. And now it's all, you know, everything has to get permitted. Everything has to get bureaucracy is everywhere. And I mean, in the US, that is even worse. And, you know, where you cannot whatever change your garden fence for 20 centimeters without having a building permit. It's crazy.
Okay, that's America. That's America. And that's my the first time I was in Germany many decades ago. And I was just in Belgium a few months ago, but my family said, you guys want to go, you know, keep going. I said, no, because I'm not the biggest fan of Germany, because it reminded me a lot about America, especially if you don't speak German in some of the places. You could be at the gas station and it's a problem, just like it is here in America, if you don't speak English. And I said, I don't, you know, all my languages are a little off. So I'll do little here, because I you know, I can say danke and get around. But no, it's interesting. So that's unfortunate. Where you guys find your home, you know, feel free to roam for you young people. Find a place that fits you best. Let the people know where they can find you and where they can find your new projects. And I thank you for coming on.
Yeah, no, totally. It was great. I had a lot of fun. So there is a website, uberballfilms.com, where uberballfilms.com, where you can find me. And you find me on Instagram, where my name is uberballfilms2, where you have, so you have uber and then an undersigned ball, undersigned films. And I'm on Twitter or X. I just cannot get over the name change. I mean, it's just insane. You know, like,
yes.
I really don't get it. And so it's Uberball 7 with the number 7 in the end, because there are various Uberballs everywhere on Instagram and on, you know, it's crazy, but I'm Uberball 7.
And those links, you guys.
Raw. What I actually do, my podcast partner, Gary Otto, he is in Florida. He lives in Florida. And we do Uberball Raw, the podcast, also a long time, but no video. We just do sound. And so I don't know how many episodes we did on this.
You guys, those links will be in the description, because you guys can listen, learn, and see that the idea that somebody just, you know, wanted to be in entertainment and it happened overnight. You're seeing a lifetime put into this. There was a sacrifice. There were times a man couldn't spend with his family. And now, and then the critics, you have to deal with those people who are, all they can do is write. Now they're using ChatGPT. So forget them, tune in, learn, and please share this game, share this information. It will change somebody's life. Be blessed, y'all.
Are you tired of the rat race in America? Are you ready to visit the motherland to relax and rejuvenate? Are you ready to explore all that Africa has to offer? Then check out the brand new Diversified Game Academy course, Prepare for My First Trip to Africa. Are you worried about being able to afford the trip? We got you. We will show you how to travel either on a budget or as a baller. Learn how to stress the value of the USD. Did you know that 100 United States dollars is worth over 1,000 South African rand, or 10,000 Kenyan shillings, or 54,250 West African CFA? Are you worried about taking your kids? Get the game from Kellen Cash, a bona fide world traveler, having traveled to almost 20 countries, several of those in Africa. Get the game on taking your kids on their first trips. Learn how to find the best tickets, get the visas, and plan your own adventures in Africa. Don't let Eddie Murphy have all the fun. Plan your own coming to Africa trip, starring you, produced by you, and featuring you. If you are ready for a life-changing experience, sign up for our course today, Diversified Game Academy. Get prepared and purchase at diversifiedgame.com.